So if we just remember, we've travelled a long way in 2 days, really, because we started off looking at the ancient image of the Tree of Life, as it was found in ancient Egypt, as the Tree of Heliopolis. So we began by looking at this very, very ancient image that's been used for thousands of years as a way of integrating opposites, as a way of connecting with the larger life of the soul and of the universe. And one of the very fundamental exercises that we did was this practice of coming into the body, coming into the senses, descending into the deep waters, and then arising out of the waters as the sort of the primal mound or the dry land, or the shaping that arises out of fluidity, which then takes life as the living tree. And finding within the living tree also the kind of the mysterious creative energy of the phoenix that continually dies and is reborn. So that was really the beginning of yesterday. And that exercise is a very fundamental exercise. It's the kind of, if you like, the fundamental practice of the Tree of Life is just to sort of come into your senses, let your form dissolve, go into the deep waters of the beginning, to trust the mysterious life of the beginning place, and to allow it to shape you. And as it shapes you, in a certain sense, it both figuratively and literally creates the dry land, the shaped land, which is in itself fertile land, which out of which this living tree arises. And from the living tree many other things arises. But we retain our connection rooted down through the fertile ground of the shaped place down into the formless waters. And so it's a continual practice of inhabiting the fertile form, letting that form pass when its time is past, is coming down into the waters again and trusting the new kind of arising. So that's a fundamental practice. We actually do it all the time. So when we're doing it consciously, we're actively participating in the process, but it is actually the process of human life. We're all the time we're creating and recreating ourselves and the universe, but so fast that it looks like it's a solid thing. It's a thingness, not a process. The more we get used to practicing that practice of descent and emergence, the more we participate in that, the more we discover that actually we've been doing it all along. Not some external thing we have to practice, it is actually something we do. The other practice we've been looking at is this practice that I learned from Colette Albuca Muscat in Holy Jerusalem. Which are this practice of these three deep breaths, followed by then an extremely swift image, followed by two swift breaths, and immediately coming back. Now that practice is a different practice from the practice that is much kind of softer and opening into and gently exploring. It's a much more focused, active practice that cuts through the normal haziness of our mind. It's quite a sharp practice. So that's that is a practice that we can do for ourselves. Also, the key thing to do is to do it quickly. You have to do it quickly, and the key element of it is to accept whatever happens. Instead of doing, oh, I'm not seeing anything, it didn't work, failed again. It really relies on you. You have to be quite sharp in that practice, sharp to notice what's happening, and sharp to accept what's happening, and then kind of get interested in it.
Because you're telling us the thing and we're not expecting it, then go ting.
Yeah.
So how do we do that ourselves?
Well, you let the deeper part of you take you by surprise.
So you just open to an image and let it go with that.
Yeah, I mean, that's literally what I'm doing. Right? When I do this practice, it's when I do the in-breath, out-breath, in, I don't actually know what I'm going to say next to that moment. Right? So that, so then the three breaths, and it's always a slightly, God, is anything going to happen kind of moment, and something appears. So then just comes out of my mouth. I'm literally, when I do these things, I'm describing what's happening to me. Right, so you can do it in the same way. You just do the breath, do the breaths, notice what's happening, go with it. So you will be taken by surprise by yourself.
Okay.
Okay. It's a little bit harder than me taking you by surprise, obviously, because that's, you know, that's because it's a stronger push if it's coming from outside. But that will also happen.
But if we're not doing it in any context, I mean, I'm sure you would be doing it in some kind of context would be. Holding, looking at one of these letters.
You could do it. You could certainly do it with that, or you could have any. Well, you can have any context for it, because if you
choose one, though,
well, you can choose. Choosing one helps because it puts you in a direction. But you can just do it as an open thing to see what's trying to emerge. You know, so you could have a very global intention, which is kind of. Well, I wonder what's trying to emerge at the moment. Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. See what emerges. Breathe in, breathe out, open your eyes, come out again. So that practice is very much to do with the energy and the and not hanging around. Because actually, if you let yourself drift a bit, you get a bit dreamy, and it loses energy. That exercise very. The other one, they're quite different exercises. Because the first one depends on relaxing into that more womb-like kind of dream-like space and works within that dream. The other one is like that. So they're complementary exercises. Those two. They kind of the one. Yeah, exactly. One's feminine, one's masculine. That's right. The other thing we started to look at yesterday really was the power of images and the fact that images have their own independent life. And one of the particular points that we looked at was this idea: if we impose premature meaning on an image through premature interpretation, we stop the process, we freeze the energy. And one of the fundamental points of yesterday is that we are in this creative process all the time. Now, we're never standing still. We're either growing or we're solidifying. So we're either opening, growing in the process of life and death, which involves a lot of, as John said, a lot of disappointment, a lot of letting go, but the breaking open of the heart and the breaking open of new life. Or we're in a process of shutting down and closing down and kind of solidifying around past history. There isn't another place. We're doing one or the other. Totally.
The breathing in and out. Is it, do we do just one image, two, three, does it matter? Because you did a few.
You can do a few in a sequence. Again, you just trust your intuition in that, right? So I think, no, you can do a whole whole sequence like that if you want to. Or you can just hang around with one and just see what happens. Okay. You know, so again, very much just, again, the whole point about this is as you find yourself at home in your own place, it's about trusting your own rhythms. We're all doing this here together, which means we've got a lot of attention and concentration going on. But as we come back into our own places, find your own relationship to these things at home in your own life, and just see how they work for you. So then we started to look at the whole kind of. Idea of part of we looked at some of the historical antecedents of this. We looked at the stuff that had happened in Egypt, stuff that happened in the Renaissance, and that aspect of the human. So we've looked at a good deal yesterday at that aspect of the human mind that solidifies and colonizes. And of course, that's absolutely out there in the world at the moment. But it's also in us. It's that part of our own mind that can kind of, that is frightened by the freshness and the disturbing quality of awareness. You know, because ultimately, as we pursue this work, we more and more we become open and have to die to the images of ourselves. The self-image and the world image that we have created more and more starts to wither away. And in a sense, what happens is that something interesting happens to our will and imagination as we kind of do this work, because it is the self level of the tree. Both in the beginning of the work, both our imagination and our will is embedded in past structures. Right, so our capacity to imagine is hemmed in by decisions that we have made, and our ability to have free will is also hemmed in, depending upon how our will, our energy of choice, has been affected by the previous experiences of our lives. So, in a certain sense, you could almost say that our will and imagination is quite encrusted and actually, in some ways, quite repetitive. We've learned to be prepared to be even to be creative in a particular way. We've learned to exercise will in a particular way. As we deepen in this experience, we start to free up both our will and imagination. We start to open our system up. And it's not about leaving things behind, because the whole point of the tree of life is actually we need to be functional at all levels. So it's not like we leave behind the personal and then become soulful, leave behind soulfulness and then become spiritual. You know, that's a sort of parody. What we're trying to do is to open the different channels of the tree of life so the whole tree is visible in its fullness. So in practice, as we kind of develop, so one of the things that we're doing here is working with will and imagination to free will and imagination. So these various exercises and practices that we do are getting us to use our will and imagination to impact the conditioned will and imagination that just repetitively cycles in our system, so to free up both capacities. And as they free up, we start then to create a different relationship to our subjective inner world, which we find in the pool of personal life. We start to open up both our feelings and our minds up to qualities of compassion and clarity. And increasingly, there's a whole sense, as the energy of the deeper part of the tree starts to descend into the pool of personal life, things become more lucid, more opened up, more present, freer. So there's a genuine, so a lot of the things that people have been talking about, images of childhood, things rise bubbling up from the past, is exactly the sort of thing you expect to happen when you bring these worlds together, because we're freeing, we're detoxifying, things are flowing. And things that have been hidden away and kind of start to be revealed. So there's a whole alchemical process that happens just by doing this. Now we went on from there really to look at this model of the tree as a set of kind of shapes, a set of forms that can be used to help us do this work. And then we went on particularly to look at the tarot pack as this odd thing that appears in the Renaissance, that actually fits incredibly well with the Tree of Life as a set of images that we can work with to help us free up our will and imagination. And a lot of the work that we've done has involved us kind of looking at the outer image, letting ourselves be impacted by that, then taking the felt sense of that inward into the inner, and allowing that to impact us on the inner, and then coming out again and looking at the image with fresh eyes. So again, the point of the tarot pack is that it's this, and we've obviously only touched some small elements of it, and we can only do a little of it in 2 days. But the whole point of it is it's a whole set of images that were designed originally to help with this process of freeing up the will and the imagination. So it's an extremely flexible, kind of interesting kind of tool, really. And so so what we've been doing really is kind of using that tool, using outer images and inner images to free our inner processes up. Now, what we did, what we started to do in this latter part of the afternoon, really, is then to do something we're quite focused upon the connection to the Tree of Life, and in particular, we've looked at two paths only, but these are central paths on the middle pillar. Now, the middle pillar, the different side pillars of the tree look at the different opposites of our being. Middle pillar's intention is to integrate and to hold things together, and to connect the deep with the surface. So the point of looking at these two paths has been to really, in some ways, to really concentrate on this area called Yesod, which is the collection of our sense of personal images. Because this is one of the key areas in terms of freeing ourselves up. Because the Yesodic self-image and image of the world, because these two things are, you know, our self-image and image of the world is actually one image. We think of it as two separate things, but actually our sense of self is intimately formed in connection with our sense of the universe. They're not separate. So though we talk about self-image, it really more accurately would be self and world image, or self and universe image. And that's the sort of the... and that combined subliminal image is the tyrant, really, that mostly causes the freezing of our processes. There's an extremely functional aspect of Yesod, which is about its ability to run things, to run processes mechanically and unconsciously, so that you're not having to do everything deliberately. And when Yesod is working at its best, it's working as a sort of unconscious, supportive process to the processes of awareness. So not making Yesod the devil here, but the problem is that the Yesodic energies have got too big. That mechanized way of maintaining safety has invaded our thinking, our feeling life, and to a certain extent even how we receive information through our senses, so inner and outer senses. So a lot of the work is really cleansing this kind of pool, bringing flow back into it, getting rid of the stagnancy within it, and allowing really the deeper part of the tree to flow through it. And so what we did then was a series of exercises involving the tarot card, the world, the tarot card temperance, and the Hebrew letters of Tav and Samech, which are, again, just images that are used in the Kabbalah to focus on these particular paths. And again, we've just skimmed the surface of it. But again, it is the same process of engaging with the outer image, letting it take, then travelling with it into the inner experience, allowing that to do whatever it does in the deeper part of us and in this Yesodic waters, and then emerging again. Now, the two paths that we have worked on, the first one is sometimes called the underworld path. It's the descent into subjective life. Because the movement from, if you like, from Malkut and the body to this kind of place of Yesod, which is the foundation of our life, in a way is our movement from our sense of ourselves and the world in the outer into our inner world, into our inner pool of life. But meeting that with awareness, meeting that consciously, meeting that with something with the intention to discover and inquire about in what's going on here. The second path, which is the path of Samech, which is the connection between the what we could call our soul level and the pool of subjective life, is the intention there is to align ourselves. This idea of Samech as the tent pole. That pole that holds everything in a centered place, and the image of the temperance or the art card, which is this alchemical process of bringing things together so there can be flow and colloquy and communion between the soul and the person and the pool of subjective life, and also later the mind and the feelings, and then fundamentally the body. So one of the images that we use, one of them.
That's really hard work.
It's hard work.
And
so it's
all that information in your head and
yeah.
Hold on to it. There's an enormous amount of.
It's enormous amount of work. So we've done an enormous amount of work, yeah. Right? So actually, that so you're going to be knackered when you finish this, because actually we've done a lot in 2 days. We've got, you know, and the short meditations I did the detail just sort of came to me, but they're based around the image of a house. Mm-hmm. And archetypally, in a sense, the house really is the house of the human soul. So the outside, when you're looking at outside, you're looking in a way at the shape of your own soul. In whatever way it presents itself, and it's fluid, it moves all the time. When you're down in the foundations, you're down in the Malkut of your house, you're down in the right down in the bottom of it, in the cellars, and noticing what's there. When you're in the kitchen, you're in the mechanical place of the house, really, where things work, where the engines, where the things are cooked, things are washed. The upper room, of course, is the place where you've got where the soul manifests in the house. So that's a place that's above that, above the mind, above the feelings. It's a place where you can start to touch on your own particular sense of spirituality. Every more time, we might have explored the study in your house, which is the place of the mind, or a place that's like a conservatory, which has lots of green life, which is like where your emotional life flourishes. There are other chambers as well. There's a chamber of, you might find there's a place in your house like a courthouse, which is where you kind of where judgment is made, or another place that's like a luxurious place of kindness. You might find another place that is the house of the deep mother, or another place where all the fathers live, or another place that's dedicated purely to spirit.
So we're recreating that practice of the guy in Florence who had the house, the
yes.
rooms.
Yes. So we're doing that inwardly. He was doing it literally outwardly. We're doing it inwardly, because we don't need to do it outwardly. We can do it inwardly. So that is exactly what Marcelo Finicio did. In his house, he created rooms. We've been creating inner rooms in our the house of our spirit, the house of our soul.
That's the sex animals, the foul rag and bone pit of the human heart, his body.
Yeah.
It?
Yeah, that's what the answer.
Everything, the sex animals, as you said, that's where everything's based.
Yeah, that's right.
Did you record this?
I am recording this.
Oh.
I hope I am anyway. Yes, I am.
I realise after 5 years, you make this up as you go along.
I do.
I
do love you.
We know that.
Yeah, I do.
Now, in a sense, we are also viewing this through your own imagination.
Of course you are, no, absolutely, definitely.
So what would you describe that as then? Is that, are you like a conduit to this?
I am like a conduit to this, because I'm leaning back into, I'm not just these, although I do make up the detail of it, I'm leaning back into this, into some of these older traditions, right? So what I have to do ever before I come to these workshops is steep myself in the material.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you know, and so that, you know, even before I write the workshop description, I have to steep us in the material. I don't even know what the workshop description is going to be until I start writing it. But it comes out of something, right? So it comes out of these. So these traditions I've been talking about, and these historical traditions I've been talking about, are the places I lean into that inform my understanding. And obviously, you know, for me, I have confidence in them because I was taught them in the way that I'm passing things on to you. These things were passed on to me, and sort of, and so whenever you're in that position, however you're doing it, you're always a link between something that's bigger than you and the people you're talking to. So my job always, and it is literally why I do have to make things up, because we have to make the work specific. It has to be very, You know, it's not mechanical. That's the point. Is, you know, if I had, here's my folder for this workshop, it would be much tidier, right? And so you'd have a much tidier experience. Whereas actually, I have to feel my way into what's trying to emerge, and as in the couple of days before the workshop, I have to feel into, well, what materials are emerging. What do I need to physically bring with me? You know, what has to, you know, sort of. I'm completely delighted with. I found these. Those coloured letters on the web, because Hebrew letters are very, very useful images, but then mostly black and white and boring. And some wonderful man in Mexico has done.
Not Jorge.
Jorge. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know him really, but I know. But he has an archive of these basic images, which obviously he's done and makes available to the world. You know, so I sort of printed them off because I thought, oh, I could use it. These will be very useful as a way of bringing these letters to life. So, you know, I have to just feel my way into that, and then things appear, just like. You know, I'd never come across these coloured letters before, and but I was struggling with. I could have just given. Well, I suppose in the end, I would have had to give you black and white letters if I couldn't find anything else. But I wanted something that had colour in it, something that had life in it, so that the images could come to life a bit more. And magically, they appeared. And that's kind of how you do these things. I think you just trust, come into your body, trust your intention, trust your intuition, and you just follow it step by step.
It reminds me of the ancient tradition of storytelling.
Yeah.
Because the bards or Scots didn't just repeat the same songs.
Mm.
For a couple of days before the feast, they would seclude themselves away, generally in the darkness, and invent a story which was an explanation of why we are here, and why we do things, and where we came from, and what is our future, and how the world became to be like it is. That was the story.
Mm.
So when I heard the word workshop, it was like the work the Scot does tells the tale.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But it gives us an understanding of why we're here.
Yeah, and that is literally what we've done this weekend, because we've looked at why are people here, what's the history, where are we, and how, and from the history, where do we take this, in a sense, you know, so it's, yeah. Yes, I know, Lily, catch your bus, yeah, absolutely.
See
you in the next one.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
You
know,
it's just
been amazing. They're yours. Yes, yeah. Thank you.
Thanks,
Eleanor. Thank you. Bye. So you know, you say you steep yourself in it. You meditate, read, go into...
I mostly meditate. I mean, obviously, I don't read so much because I've read myself to death with these things over the years. So I don't. So that I look at images a lot. I feel into it. I just feel into it. Well, what I have to do is, well, I sort of lean into my sense of the Kabbalah, my sense of the tradition. I sometimes get confused by things. I didn't realize the Egyptian stuff was going to come in as strongly, and. You know, so I was saying to Ali, I don't know quite what I've done. I've suddenly bunged. When I was setting up my room, I suddenly had an instinct to put the Four Children of Horus and Camoest in the middle of a room, and an alabaster chalice. Normally, there's just a candle in the middle of that room. So at the point I was doing that, I didn't know quite why I was doing it. I know, you know, I know that I'm very, and I had to be careful about what I was doing there, because I'm very interested in Egyptian stuff at the moment. And I didn't want to do it because I'm interested in Egyptian stuff and needed it to happen because it somehow was going to be useful to us as a group. So there's a lot of being with the unknown, really, and just trusting the, you know, of course, checking myself. I had to check myself to make sure I just don't want to do it with you. I just want to talk about Egypt because I want to talk about Egypt, but because that was wanting to emerge. So there's a lot of just sort of... having to trust the material and go with the flow of it sometimes, and sometimes without knowing what's actually going to happen.
Mm-hmm. So for myself, I find that, you know, I just seem to feel like I spend nearly all my time working
working. I don't read. Don't watch interesting programs. I don't do anything like that.
Yeah.
And what I've noticed, because it frustrates me that I don't have space to meditate particularly.
Yeah.
You know, we can all sit and go, well, you could create space, mate. Yes, I could, but I don't want to. I kind of have that conversation with myself.
Yeah, sure.
But I kind of think, what I've noticed in a very busy life is these things emerge in the weirdest way.
Yeah.
So I can find myself in a meeting, you know, a load of CEOs sitting around a table, and suddenly I get an image in my head and I think, oh, God, what am I going to do with that? So I carry on talking, you know, and then I kind of sit with that image, and then I somehow find a vehicle to bring it into the space without making anyone go, what is she going on about?
Yeah.
And it either ends up on a flip chart or I start to do something with it.
Yeah.
And then I allow the rest of the people to take it where they want to go.
Yeah, right.
Now, no one has ever asked me what the hell I'm doing, which is really interesting, because I would, if I was sitting there in the audience, I'd think, what on earth is she doing? And I find it very interesting how it how your work kind of emerges through other frames of reference, completely unrelated.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Yeah, and I find that fascinating.
No, and I think that's the interesting thing, really, because as you embody this stuff and as you feel connected with it, you then, whatever frame of reference you're in, because actually this is what happens here. I come with all what I'm doing. You guys come. We create the frame of reference together, and the you know, broad ideas of where we're going, but the particular direction depends upon the shared context we create. And the same way, when you're sitting with a group of CEOs, or you've got a big lecture into a big group of people, that's your frame of reference. So that's the, as the energy, as the image emerges, it emerges in parallel with the context. So it somehow meets the it'll meet the context in the way that enables something new to come into the room. And that's why, because it's matching the context precisely, because you're just trusting how it's coming through you, that's why people don't say, what the hell is she talking about? Because actually you're touching the nerve of something that's trying to emerge in the group field.
And then I find that they then give it back to me.
Yes, exactly.
They give it back to me, and it's like receiving a little present.
Oh. Yeah, that's right. No, well, it has its own life then. You see, that's exactly what happens. So it then returns, and that's interesting.
Which of course is what happens in here, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally. Exactly what happens.
Back to you, changed, or in their own way.
Added to in some way.
And then I find I stick all of that back into a melting pot, like an alchemic kind of internal world.
That's right.
And then from that, I then create a plan.
Yeah, exactly. That's the alchemy. Go on.
What I was going to say is perhaps the obvious thing, but that's what the magician does. That's the art of the magician.
Yeah,
you
completely.
You might see yourself as a magician because that's kind of old world stuff that nobody takes seriously anymore. But the fact nobody asks you what you're doing is because they are under your spell.
Yeah, that's real.
And you've spelled out something for them, which they then take. That's what magicians do. That's why the magician is a key figure in the major arcana.
Yeah.
You do the mystery thing with them.
And then I come back and I read your poetry, Jim, and I think, oh, that's what I've been talking about all day. He's pulled it together.
Yeah, that's right.
I was seeing the phrase casting, which I can't, it's biblical, but I can't remember exactly what it's talking about, but casting the bread upon the waters, and then, and I'm not sure what happens after that happens, but it might be that comes back.
I think the implication is that it comes back, I think,
And that's the waters are very important, I've casted a little bit of water. And very water.
I was just going to say, I suppose the key, though, is having all that knowledge behind you and also the trusting and the experience of what you've both done and how you've worked. And you can only really work like that because of the knowledge and the experience, and you've learned to trust it and go with it. And you've got that in the beginning, it's
not quite.
No, you can't. I mean, in the beginning, these things are much more external because you have to internalize them. So that's, so when I remembered at the beginning of this weekend, sitting there and I was 15, meditating on the tree and then meditating on the tower, you know, all those years ago. Now then, that's of course completely external. It isn't in me. I haven't created those connections, and so it is about internalizing something that then does become part of you. So then your preparation for that is to tune in to yourself, or tune and through that you tune into something that's bigger than yourself.
What was your introduction to the tree? Because tarot's fairly, well, not entirely obvious, but it's not so weird. Was the tree? Being around it for ages, and suddenly it was a sort of clunk thing. But what was your?
First of all, I was just interested in the idea of magic, right? So, of course, in those days, you couldn't get older books on magic. But I remember I was looking in Exchange and Mart one day, which is a. I don't think it probably exists anymore. Exchange and Mart is mainly used to sell cars. It was in the back of Exchange and Mart there was an advertisement for Thorson's Press, which quite a lurid advertisement about learned to do magic and books for magic. And so I wrote off to them and I got sent this catalogue. And one of the books was a book called Apprentice to Magic by W. E. Butler. And actually, there's another book called Inner Traditions of Magic by Bill Gray. And it was one of these choice points in my life that I didn't know was a choice point. But Ernest's book was a quid cheaper. And a quid, also a quid was a lot in those days. And it was certainly a lot when you're, and that's a huge amount when you're 15. So I decided to write off Ernest's book. And he writes in that a series of Kabbalistic lessons, really, that are about the Tree of Life and about working with magic. And in that he tells you kind of by Dion Fortune's Mystical Kabbalah, which I found a difficult book, but that summer got me started. And actually, it was a lot to do, really, in some ways with Ernest's tone. He was very practical, very clear, no bullshit,
no ego.
No, he's a lovely bloke. He's a very lovely bloke, Ernest. And so but above all, he gave me something I could do and practice and work with. And although I did find the Mystical Kabbalah quite dry and quite difficult, because I'd got sort of ideas from Ernest, and he also recommended a book by Paul Foster Case called The Tarot. And so that's how I started. So I used that book to look at the tarot, and Ernest's book and the Mystical Kabbalah to look at the Tree of Life. And I did that for a couple of years, and then summoned up the courage to write to Ernest to discover that he was teaching a small school of Kabbalah called, they had not long started up, had probably been going about 8 or 9 years by the time I joined it, called the Helios Course on the Practical Kabbalah.
Where was that?
Well, it was all over the place because Ernest lived in Southampton, and my personal teacher Tom lived in Chelmsford. So I learned Kabbalah in Chelmsford, in mystic Essex. that's where I learned it. And sort of, and of course, it was this very secret world, and sort of, No, I know. Well, I had to argue my way in, because in those days, because such a long time ago, you had to be 21 to join a mystic school. I was underage, so I had to argue my way in. So they let me in when I was 18. So and because I begged, kind of, and I wouldn't go away, and
to get there for a 50-year-old, you're even an 18-year-old. To actually get from Wales to Chelmsford.
It was quite an adventure. I know it was very exciting going to Chelmsford, because you'd have to catch a train to London, and then you'd go from Waterloo and you catch a train down to Chelmsford, and then you had to get from Chelmsford to Wickham's Bishops. Well, Whittam, rather. Train to Whittam, and then I had to get either a taxi or walk from Whittam to the little village called Wickham Bishops. It was very exciting.
I mean,
it was the Far East, but it was also going to see the Man of Magic, right? So this is, Tom was this magic, very low-key, but very powerful bloke, really, who kind of, and I mean, Ernest, I didn't have such a close relationship with because he was the director of the school and he didn't bother with 18-year-olds, I don't think. But he was a lovely bloke. Whereas Tom was my personal teacher, and I used to go and stay with him regularly and always be grateful to him and Peter, his partner, really, because they. I mean, I was this rather ignorant kid from South Wales, really, who. And it wasn't just magic. They taught me about life. You know, I'd got to know a gay couple. You didn't in those days. I mean, it was a sort of, and they were discreet about their sexuality and their relationship because they'd had to be much of their lives. But Tom was a primary school teacher. Peter was the general manager of the perfume company Floris. And so when I came from a pretty horrible home, really. So I used to go to this house. It was like paradise. It used to smell wonderful because it had all these amazing Floris perfumes in it. So it was a very, you know, I was very fortunate, I think, you know, and I met, so that I didn't really come across all the madness that's around occultism until much later in my life, because actually I was held by Ernest and also by Tom, and at a time before that when it wasn't very glamorous, it was just a very quiet, small-scale sort of thing, and then later on it, as the 70s moved on apace, it became a much more glamorous and in some ways disturbed organization, really, sadly.
You were in heaven or paradise?
I was. It was an amazing kind of time, really. And I can remember later on I got a car driving over to Whittam in my old A40.
Musicians surrounded by flowers again.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, and also garden. They were phenomenal. They were phenomenal.
What? Andy was just asking, where was I?
Ali came along a little later on because after we got together. So Ali came to visit Tom and me for quite some years. Mm-hmm. And it was a
lovely period.
It was nice. Yeah, Tom came with us to choose our first house up in Norfolk. And he drove us around. It was great. I was very fortunate from that point of view, really. And lucky, in a way, I think, to catch the Kabbalah at a time before it became very commercialised and popular. You know, so that's reminiscences of Ian.
Just as a matter of interest.
Yeah.
Ernest, did he have a link back to the Golden Door or not?
No, he was linked to the...
Laura's always used to say, oh, you know, she carries on the Golden Door, and that it was Ernest who... sort of passed it on.
No, that's just not true at all. Ernest was a member of the Society of the Inner Light, so he was linked to the Society of the Inner Light. Dion Fortune was his personal teacher.
Really?
She'd had some training in the Golden Dawn and then set up her own fraternity, really, Dolores makes too much of lineage, I'm afraid, and I really dislike the idea of lineage because it's become one of these things that people claim, you know, that I am important because so and so taught me and they taught, and you know, it's silliness, really. Any final things just before we finish? We're just about on 5 o'clock. Anything that anybody's...
Would you kind of say, before we met again,
yes,
would it be worth acquainting ourselves with the stuff that we didn't have time to do, the kind of the top bit of the middle pillar?
Actually, no. It would be a bit better to look at the bottom part of the tree.
What about the two...
Well, that we've done...
Yeah, the things that we've done. I would go over the things that we've done. If you want to get interested in other bits of the tree, get interested in the. You've got a lot of information there. Get interested in the paths that we haven't taken, which are these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 paths. 5 paths around there. So you could have a look at all that if you want to. I wouldn't go up into the higher realms of the tree. We're going to do that later on, really. But I think do it quite lightly. I think the most important thing to do is to go over the work that we have done, the exercises that we've done, the actual practices that you've got, and deepen those. I mean, that's be the key thing. Obviously, if you have any further questions, you can email me or call me, and we can talk about it. Really, so so if you find yourself confused or stuck, just let me know. Obviously, and I'll help you kind of work it out. We're touching the hem of a massive subject. Obviously, right? That's the thing about it. And so even the tarot in the tree, there's a huge amount of stuff here that we could talk about, and we will talk about. But the key thing right now is to consolidate. We've done two very intense days, so consolidate your understanding. Yeah.
Is there a password for the talks?
No, this will be on the public page. Public page is a one-off workshop, so no password for that. Okay. They are yours to keep. Yeah, resources. So resources to take away and sit with the various things I've given you. Sit with them, look at them, see what they say to you. Okay, let's just take one moment to breathe and... I just want to thank the angels and archangels just before we finish, really. So let's just take a breath, come back into your body, find yourselves. In the north, I thank Hapi, the baboon who stretches his arms out for the rising of the sun. I thank Nephthys, the mother of darkness, who brings us rest. I thank Auriel, angel of the north, who spreads his wings above, below, and all around. Go in peace. In the west, I thank Kebsenuf, who spreads his wings over the peaceful dead. I thank Serket, who detoxifies the world. I thank Gavriel, who raises his wings above, below, and all around. Go in peace. In the south, I thank Imseti, who shows us the shining face. I thank Isis, who embraces us with her wings. I thank Mikael, who brings his wings above, below, and all around. Go in peace. In the east, I thank Duamatef, who opens the way before us. I thank Nit, who weaves the worlds into being. I thank Raphael, who extends his wings above, below, and all around. Go in peace. May we all go in peace.